2 meters and 70 centimeters is 50 watts. And it has, obviously 2 meter, you have the upper sideband, you got the single sideband, on 2 meters and 70 as well.
Sounds like a nice rig. And you've owned it so far, how long, huh? Sounds to me like you've only had it for about a month or so.
Affirmative. Not even. Probably around, 2 weeks. It literally just came out on the market. So, very, very nice radio from, other people have told me, that through a lot of HF, they've played with it a little bit with me, getting it all tuned, etc. They say, they can't believe how quick, and I'm sure if Phil Gomez is around W2, Whiskey Mike, our president, I can't think of the call, the auto tuner is so quick how it tunes. It's hit the button and it's tuned. Maybe if he's on, he can give some words on that.
Hey, you said our president, that's Joe W2BMP. Is that the guy you're referring to, Matt?
Affirmative. He just saw the rig today, as a matter of fact.
And does Joe also own one, or he's thinking of buying one, Matt?
Negative. He does, strictly QRP. He's, 100 watts is a little much for him. But, he was amazed at how quick, the auto tuner tuned into the frequency.
That sure does sound like a nice function. Thank you, Matt, for that info. John, what kind of, mailbag questions that we had so far this week. Also, you've been probably keeping track of Echolink. Has anyone been trying to communicate with us on Echolink? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the second half.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Paul, everyone on the net. No, Echolink is loaded up, but nobody's questioning, and same thing on the chat room. No questions. But we have a couple of mailbag questions, and I've combined two of them because they're almost identical. Let me let it drop. And this way you'll be able to combine them. I think it's more reasonable for you to handle it this way. It's on, get it right. Okay. Two gentlemen are asking slightly different questions on squelch control. One is asking, how does it work? And maybe you could describe how the RF squelch control works. The other gentleman is asking, how does it recognize on voice squelch? How does that work when it's looking for voice signals, doesn't open up on just RF character? So maybe you can handle that, Dick, and we'll move on. KC2WGB.
KC2WGB has a quickie answer.
Go ahead with the quickie answer, Hal.
Okay, I just ran into the room here. I happen to hear squelch. Question, John. He wants to know how it distinguishes between audio. Give me the question again, John, so I can make sure to give you a proper answer.
Yes, Hal. He's asking how the basic RF squelch works. The other gentleman is asking about the squelch that will only open up when it hears an intelligent voice. They're both asking basically how squelch works, but there are two different types. So back to you, Hal.
Okay, let's take the RF squelch first. That's the easiest to explain. The RF squelch works off the ABC. What happens when there's a signal present, there's an ABC voltage. The ABC voltage is a negative voltage which controls the gain of the IF stages and the RF stages, depending on what type of receiver it is, of course. So what happens when you control the gain of these stages on the grid and you induce a negative ABC voltage, You have a threshold. Now, there's two types of RF squelches. You could have a diode RF squelch, or you can have audio gate RF squelch. Diode RF squelches, we're able to switch a diode on and off to pass audio into the audio stage of the receiver. And the way this works is they sample some DC voltage off the screen grid, sometimes off the IF. And the screen voltage on the IF and the ADC change will automatically go higher. When the IF voltage goes higher, because when you have ADC voltage, your IF tube is drawing less current. Less screen current is being drawn, the voltage across the screen goes up. This forward biases a diode, which has audio pass through the diode, and this acts as a squelch action. And what they do, they bias the diode with a back voltage, where the diode is just about to conduct. But when this added voltage, hold on, I don't want to lose myself. When this added voltage overcomes the back bias voltage on the diode, audio passes. Okay, next one. Let's talk about another RF squelch. Another RF squelch is where they use a tube that they float the first audio stage of the receiver on the grid. And they run the cathode and the grid at a higher potential, like about 50 volts. And what they're doing, they pull the grid voltage down to about 30, 40 volts, which cuts off the tube. Now, when the squelch tube, which plate is connected to the grid through our network, and the voltage goes up and there's a negative voltage on the squelch tube, the first audio tube goes into conduction. And they adjust the amount of bias on that first audio, the grid, so it just cuts off, negative voltage comes on from the AGC, turns on the grid. Okay, is everybody on that so far? Then we'll go into the noise-canceling squelch used in FM. This is used in carrier AM. They don't use it in CW, primarily in carrier AM. Go ahead.
Okay, Al, continue.
Okay, now we're going to talk about the FM squelch and why it doesn't get affected. In the FM squelch, basically what they're doing, they take the audio signal off the discriminator, and they take only the high frequency component of the signal. It's a high pass filter. Now they take and rectify this audio signal, and then they, oh, I'm sorry, let's get it right. I got so much on my head tonight that you have to bear with me. They take the audio signal, which is coming off the discriminator. It goes into a variable pot, some sort of control circuit. It goes into an amplifier, which amplifies this high-frequency audio signal, the noise. Okay, now, first off, in FM, when you have, normally with a shot noise or background noise, there's no signal, no carrier. As soon as carrier comes on, the background noise drops. Now imagine this audio amplifier amplifying high frequency noise, then it goes into a detector. Detector develops a positive voltage. This positive voltage automatically drives another tube or transistor to cut off the audio output stage of the receiver. Now assume, and what you do, you set the threshold by varying what we call the squelch control for the amount of noise it takes to shut down the transistor or the first audio stage in the receiver. Now, when the carrier comes on, automatically, this noise drops. When the noise drops, the DC voltage being rectified goes lower. DC voltage being rectified goes lower. It automatically causes the control transistor or tube to turn on the audio stage, and wallow, you got audio going through the receiver. Go ahead, Dick.
Now, we're switching positions tonight. Hal gave you the complete solution. I'm going to give you the brief answer. In the case of an FM discriminator, it really is a differentiator. In other words, it favors high-frequency notes. When you get a weak signal going into a discriminator, you'll notice you start getting a hiss in the background. So the squelch circuit of an FM receiver looks at the high-frequency noise, and if that high-frequency noise, through all of its circuits, is above a certain threshold, it cuts off the audio. If the high-frequency noise gets quiet enough, which means the carrier is strong enough, it allows the audio to go through. In the case of many of our HF receivers, you know the way your signal strength meter works, and you can set a particular knob that when the signal strength meter goes above a certain number, the audio is enabled. When the signal strength meter is below a certain number, the audio amplifier is not enabled, and the receiver becomes quiet. There's a third kind of audio operating circuit. Let me drop.
Good day.
The third kind of circuit is called VOX, voice-operated relay. When astronaut Neil Armstrong stepped onto the moon, and he said those famous words, one small step for man, he should have said amen, you'll notice that the audio dropped out momentarily. In other words, his voice wasn't loud enough. The voice-operated circuits on some of our rigs, when they rectify the voice, and when it comes above a certain threshold, it enables the transmitter to be turned on, particularly a single sideband transmitter, but sometimes FM transmitters. And also, you got to be a little bit careful with that, because sometimes the transmitter, the receiver making noise in the room, you would think would give you a false alarm, turning on your voice-operated relay. And they have the so-called anti-vox circuits. So in other words, the amount of volume coming out of your loudspeaker gives you a small amount of negative voltage, even though you're getting a positive voltage out of the microphone circuit. And the two, when they get it balanced just right, the noise out of the loudspeaker doesn't give you a false alarm of your voice-operated relay. But as you speak into it, the transmitter becomes enabled. It's a little bit troublesome. The voice-operated relay maybe is pretty friendly to use during a contest. Let me drop.
Yes, we were talking about receivers. You're bringing in VOX on transmitters. That's changing the game plan here.
He asked about VOX. So that the voice-operated relay is something that if you're holding a rag chew with a guy operating sideband, voice-operated relay can be kind of annoying, where the transmitter is turning on and off in between each of his words and in between the individual syllables. So voice-operated relay, for an astronaut where he doesn't have a free hand to turn on and off the transmitter, and just his speaking into his microphone inside of his helmet turns it on, is kind of convenient, but it's got some disadvantages. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, now in the VOX system, they could also build in a delay adjustment, correct, Dick, where it won't turn off the VOX immediately after they pause. Is that correct?
Yeah, quite often a VOX circuit will have an attack control and a delay control. In other words, the guy will usually set the attack time very fast, so that the beginning of the first syllable enables the transmitter. But then when he stops talking, you want it to hang for a certain length of time, the length of time in between his words, so to speak. If he's got a half a second in between the end of one word and the beginning of the next, it would be nice for it to hang for the full half second, and therefore not chopping up the space between the words, if you know what I mean. And there's a compromise here. You set the hang time long enough, it's pleasant to listen to, but if you're trying to go back and forth between transmitters and answers, that delay can be kind of troublesome. There are the equivalent of voice-operated relays on some kinds of international telephone circuits, particularly the ones operating through satellites. And there are times when that can be pretty troublesome, where you end up with both people talking and both people listening, and nobody hears anything that's going on, if you know what I mean. And sometimes the only way to get around that, if you find yourself involved in one of those circuits, is that when you've completed a statement, you say to the man, over. Now, in other words, you're telling him, now you talk, and then at the end of his speech, he says, over to you, because if people keep jumping on top of each other with excited comments, on some of these circuits, you can end up with both talking and nobody hears anything. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
This DPZ with a comment.
Go ahead, Hal.
Trying to wait for the beep. Okay, also, Dick forgot to mention, VOX circuit that's used in a lot of these transceivers also is used for CW break-in. Now what happens is the CW generates a tone. Tone actuates the VOX, which actuates the transmitter. And you can set the VOX with some delay so you can work a CW and use it for break-in and CW and transmit. That's my little comment.
Thank you, John. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, a couple little things.
a lot of today's videos, and the squelch and the audio circuits, there's a FET basically turning on and off. And as far as like most receivers, you have a noise detector. And that one's a comparator, the other side is a comparator, goes to blah, which is at the level. It's a more modern day stuff. But the other thing is that there's other forms of squelch, like phone squelch, or digital coded squelch. Whereas that it's set up so it's invisible to your ear, but essentially you're sending information that says I'm transmitting, you don't have to worry about signal or noise. Whereas most of the noise-based circuits that we work with really are signal noise detectors. In essence, is what they are. You know, as far as like the specifics of the voltages that are being used, really all up to the designer. We typically think of the ATC voltage as a negative going voltage, but in today's world, when you have a single 5-volt supply, you don't get negative voltages. So you take a slightly different approach. Get your IWP to the chart.
KCPC with another comment.
One of the things that Eric just brought up is called CTCSS, Continuous Tone Coded Squelch System. This particular repeater, most of the time, is set up so that when you transmit to it, you give it a carrier, the carrier-operated relay, the core circuit, becomes enabled, but unless the transmitter, unless the receiver sees a 136.5 hertz tone, which is a very low frequency audio, most of us with a small loudspeaker coming out of a receiver won't even hear it, but unless that tone is present, the repeater transmitter is not enabled. And that gives you a kind of geographic selectivity. This particular repeater happens to have the exact same frequency as Torrington, Connecticut, and Frenchtown, New Jersey, and they each have their own individual squelch tone, not 136.5. The other one might be 100 hertz or 67 hertz or whatever. So unless that particular transmitter hears that particular low-frequency tone, squelch, what is it called now? I've forgotten the name for it, CTCSS tone, PL, we call it PL because let me drop.
I have a comment, Dick.
I know. In the beginning, Motorola used to call it private line PL, so we call it PL. Unless the correct PL tone from a transmitter in that geographic area is received by the repeater, then the repeater will not be enabled. K60BZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Al.
K2RIW, I'm talking about K60BZ. Okay, subaudible tone is primarily used in FM. On AM, they use what is called tone burst, which is a high-frequency tone anywhere from 1,500 cycles to maybe 2,100 cycles as a burst for control, or can even open up an audio circuit. Subaudible tone, years ago, utilized what we call vibrating reeds. A reed is a very selective vibrating device. It's tuned. And automatically what happens, when a subaudible tone came in, the reed is a precision device. It would vibrate. Once the reed would vibrate, it had a pair of contacts. There were two types of reeds, a contact reed and a contactless reed. The first ones were contact reeds. Started to vibrate. There was a little contact with the reed where it made momentary contact. This automatically had a little voltage potential on it, which charged a capacitor, which had a voltage which actuated the squelch circuit. The contactless reed was basically a double reed coil. As the reed vibrated, one coil induced the reed to vibrate magnetically, and then the other side of the reed induced voltage into another coil. This other voltage was induced in the other coil, automatically was rectified by many different methods, and also controlled turning on the squelch. The other thing they also was very handy as an encoder, because being it had two coils, they made it into an oscillator, where the signal from the primary coil fed back to the secondary, and it went into oscillation, so it developed a tone. Now, the other type that they went into next was called a twin T. A twin T is a resistance capacitance network that's very selective of the frequency. But when the frequency of these components were just right, there was a phase shift, and it caused this twin T to oscillate. Once the twin T oscillated, they coupled off that circuit, AC voltage, which also was rectified in the form, and opened the squelch. So there's a lot of different things. Suborbital tone cannot be heard. It rides along with the modulated carrier and an FM transmitter. It's detected in the discriminator or the receiver. It goes through a low-pass filter to pull out only the low frequency, and then an amplifier to drive the PL circuits. That's my little comment, Dick. Pick it up.
Yeah, thank you, Hal. Eric, did you say you wanted to say something?
Nah, it's okay. Although the leads are actually, if you want to think of it, is a tuning board. There's a whole lot of mechanical things in the olden days that really
called banana reeds, by the way. They were integrated
circuits. Zero, Charlie, two. Fox, Yankee, Yankee.
Fox, Yankee, Yankee, recognize Kilo Charlie 2. We're going to get to you in a second, sir. The, all of a sudden I lost my train of thought. KC2, Fox, Yankee, Yankee, start off with your name, sir, and your question or comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, the name is Wires, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Echo, Sierra, and I'm coming in through Echo Link, so hopefully you're able to copy. My question is about a GE Master 2 power supply that I have. It's a rack mountable, 27 amps. The no-load voltage is about 15. I'd like to hook it up to an amplifier that is rated for about 13.8, but I'm wondering if that's going to be an issue, no-load voltage being up towards 15. That's my first question. Over.
Input for that power supply is 12.8 volts. The unloaded it can be anywhere from 0.2
to 2. With a comment. Yeah, we're going to temporarily jump subjects to answer what Mr. Wires, and then we're going to come back to this particular subject. A little more to it. Go ahead. Will he be able to adjust that power supply for where he wants it to? Hal, K16PZ, K2RIW.
There's no regulator. It's brute force. It's an auto transformer.
Okay, here's what you do if you want to play it safe. Take a couple very large diodes, like are used in an alternator of a car. Each diode will basically drop 7/10 of a volt. Put a couple diodes in series to equal the amount of voltage you want to subtract, and then you will have the right voltage under load. That's my little comment.
One single diode, if it has 7/10 of a volt drop, would drop this 15 volts down to 14.3. That's getting into the right ballpark as I see it. On top of that, some of those diodes, when you put massive current through them, go a little bit beyond 7/10 of a volt drop. So maybe one diode will do it. What do you think, Hal?
You got to use a big diode. I don't know what his load is of the amplifier on the other end. And he's really going to pull a lot of current. Tie two of the diodes in parallel. That will give you twice the current capability of the diodes. And the diode will maintain a constant drop source. Go ahead, Dick.
Dick, you know that power supply is designed for a continuous 100% duty cycle amplifier. The amp draws about 18 amps. Normally it's hooked up to it.
Yeah, give me a couple words on this one, Eric. Because of that auto-transformer-like... you call it auto, maybe it's one of these resonating transformers. If he is periodically loading it, will it behave in a undesirable manner? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Ferromagnetic core transformer, K60PZ.
Think of an auto transformer like a variac, okay? There's no secondary, it's all one way. That power supply doesn't care, just don't put a short on it. On some of them, it's a big 30 amp fuse on the back of it. That's actually where you get your output is the master 2 amp. Master 3 amp, you get a nice connector on it. Power supply, rather. I have lots of them. You can't kill those things.
But it doesn't have a voltage adjust knob. It's done by the ferro-resonance and the design of the transformer. Therefore, as I see it, large power diodes as a poor man's LDO, low dropout regulator, so to speak, is a way approximately 7/10 of a volt drop on each series diode, and make sure the diodes you're using using are rated for the current you're using, and maybe you might have to use a heat sink on those diodes to be doubled.
Something, when you put about an amp on the thing, it drops down to the 15 volt. Other comments?
You're saying the 15 volt ferro resonant transformer with a load will drop down?
Big, giant capacitors in the output. I got another comment, Dick.
I know, Hal. Eric, are you saying, I want Eric to finish his thought. Are you saying, Eric, that even though he is measuring 15 volts, and maybe he's measuring it with no load, are you saying it's going to come down to 13 volts under load? Is that what you're trying to say, Eric?
Yes, sir, Dick. No. Put some load on it. You watch it. Voltage dropped to around 13, 12, 9, something like that. And it hangs there forever.
Now, here's a question I'm going to ask both of you guys. If I've got a piece of electronics that's rated for 13.8 volts, but I give it, let me pick a number, 14.5 volts under load, is that going to get me into trouble? I think most of the time not, because some automobiles, if it's made for automobile service, some automobiles will periodically put out that kind of voltage. I'm going to ask each one of you guys in sequence. KE2EJ first. Go ahead, Eric.
K2IWK2DI. You know when your battery is really discharged, your voltage regulator wants to hit it fast, so you're going to get the 14.5 volts. From the commercial point of view, I mean, the transistors that we use are listed as, you know, 12.8 volts or 12.6 volts, but look at the maximum rating. You know, big, they don't care. Even CMOS, you use voltage regulators, you know, F5, something like that. So the input side of those things don't really give a damn either. So I mean, if we're talking about power amp, what am I afraid of? Designed for big on current to start with. Well, I've never hesitated with an amplifier. No, you know, the kind of power changer people do.
So what I'm sensing, what Eric is saying, that most pieces of electronics made for mobile service are going to tolerate that excess voltage. K6DPZ, let's see what you feel on that one, Hal. K2RIW.
Dick, I concur with Eric, but there's one other thing I wanted to add. A ferromagnetic core regulated power supply has a non-polarized capacitor off the, one of the windings. That capacitor receives 400 to 500 volts AC. Be very careful working around that supply. It could send you to the happy hunting ground.
No, that's very true. It does bite. But as far as regulator goes, Dick, don't think of it as regulating DC, that it is regulating the output of that transformer.
Understand, Eric, I own one of those, and I've studied the way it behaves, and they are very, very nice. Now, on the subject of squelch, which I'm getting back to, one of the popular techniques in Europe is something that I think the Europeans will call a whistle-up repeater. In other words, in some case,
in that, that's what they use in the end.
Okay, but I think you have to supply something like a 1.8 kilohertz tone in the microphone circuit of your transmitter in order for the repeater in Europe, in London, for instance, to be enabled. I think they call that whistle up. I'm going to ask each one of you guys, because you both Eric first, and then Hal in that order. KE2EJ, give us some words on whistle up repeater type of... a kind of a PL, if you know what I know, a kind of a private line circuit. You got it, Eric, K2LAW.
1750KC.
Depends on the country, actually. And if you'll notice in your radios, some radios have multiple frequencies, but Hal's right, 1750 is the standard frequency. But I think the repeaters that I used in Paris was 1800. But basically, that's a switch to turn it on, and as long as people are yapping, you don't have to do that, but it depends on the time out. Could be seconds, could be minutes, but every place that I've had. I can't whistle, so I put the radio to it. All of the periods that I've ever used in Europe have a pretty long space before you have to whistle up again. So, okay. RWK2J.
Now, I had gotten a reciprocal license for England when I was in London a whole lot of years ago. I knew I was going into one of his repeaters that had a whistle-up tone requirement, but it was not enabled at the time, and I wanted to enable the repeater. trying to run in the full duplex mode. I had two handy talkies. One I placed across the room so that it was capable of hearing the repeater output, and the other handy talkie was in my hand. And with my mouth, I slowly increased the tone until I hit 1750. And even though my radio wasn't equipped with that whistle-up circuit built into it, where you press a button and it does all this automatically, I was able to do it with my mouth. Anyway, any comments on that, K2LAW?
Nick, I have one more comment, then I got to run about a ferromagnetic power supply.
Give us your power supply ferromagnetic info.
There is a resonant winding on that power supply that has a non-polarized capacitor, and that resonant power supply winding develops anywhere from 5 to 700 volts AC, and it could be lethal. That's my only comment. You're talking about a 12-volt high current power supply, but don't overlook the resonant winding. It can hurt you.
Yeah, there's really a number of windings there. You've got the 110-volt input, and you got this ferro-resonant winding. So, like any other pieces of electronics.
Part of the same primary.
In other words, it's an auto-transformer primary with some of that winding has this AC electrolytic capacitor across it. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Polar top outside the cap. It does get nasty. It's, think of it as a step-up transformer that's providing reverse hysteresis, you know, a little magnetic field to work against itself. And then, of course, the secondary winding is the secondary winding. Nothing to do with the primary winding. It's really looking to create a constant magnetic field depending upon what the incoming line voltage is. So that way the output doesn't go up and down.
Bingo! So as you can tell, John, when it comes to Vox-like circuits, squelch-like circuits, whistle-up circuits, when it comes to enabling AM transmitters, FM transmitters, even in enabling the audio output of a receiver, there are kinds of receivers that will have a squelch tone is required on the signal it's receiving before the audio circuit becomes enabled. And in that situation, only the desired signals you want to listen to that have that particular so-called sub-audio tone present will enable the loudspeaker, and therefore your wife doesn't have to listen to a whole lot of chatter all day long. She only hears your particular transmitter because your transmitter has that particular tone, a subaudible tone, along with your radio. There's lots and lots of circuits along these lines that have been designed over the years. It's not a simple subject. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
6DPZ, Nick, you forgot about ConoRap, the 60s.
It almost doesn't exist anymore. Now, that was a, what was it now, a protection circuit back in the days when we thought we were going to get the nuclear war. We were teaching our students to duck and cover. Was that part of the ConoRap? Over to you for some words on that one, Hal.
You know, we still have a very active system. We just don't call it that anymore.
Derek, you fill him in. I got to work out a sick puppy downstairs.
Yeah, what do we call it now? We don't call it ConoRap. What do we call it now, Eric?
Okay, it's actually lately been more and more administered by the Department of Homeland Security. It is known as the Emergency Alert System, EAS. Okay, and it is a rather sophisticated system. Not only affects broadcasters, it affects cable systems. It is now being integrated into cell phones and cell sites, and there's potential for making really big mistakes. And we've had some issues where actually the alert tones were part of a commercial and it's firing off receivers everywhere. So I'm happy that people got fined pretty nicely when it's not happening again. But anyway, that's what it's called. As opposed to the days of ConoRap where there was separate transmitters on these kept clear frequencies. That went away in the 60s, the early part of the mid-60s, somewhere in there. Don't quote me on that, because I'm not really sure. I can look it up. K2IWKJJ.
Dick, to me, it's 1YY. In the emergency alert system today, who sends out the tone? In other words, your Department of Homeland Security realizes that we're in an emergency situation. They send out a tone. I presume ordinary broadcast material becomes interrupted, and instead you're starting to send a canned program saying, Please tune to these particular frequencies in order to get the rest of the information you need in order to survive the situation. Is that approximately what happens, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RAW.
W2YY, you may have somebody trying to break in an IRLP, Dick.
Okay, we're going to get to you and that IRLP person in that order, but Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay, here is the broadcast here. First of all, the protocol, the way the EAN works, there are many different levels of alert. There's a, if you're a station in the Midwest, you might be detecting weather alerts, you know, adding that information as a call on your screen, if you're making voice announcements in your radio. If, let's say, there is a presidential emergency, a, you know, national emergency, but the highest level of alert, essentially all broadcasters will go into this mode, where they might carry the tune somewhere, but more than likely, the way things are going is that they will tell you that the program is interrupted, please stand by for the incoming message to the various networks. Information will be distributed to all the broadcasters. But who initiates the alert is in different levels. You have, starting from the top, you have a presidential alert or a national alert. You have a governor, a statewide alert. You have a mayoral, citywide alert, which is very, it can be broken down into different levels of locale. So it's really kind of sophisticated in how it can be integrated. Amber alerts can even be detected in this whole entire system. KTRIWK2J.
KTRIWK with Thomas.
Go ahead, Matt. Sounds like you've looked at the system also.
Yes, I'm the, and then there's also, you know, like he was saying, city alerts and local alerts. A lot of areas now, you know, like a red alert system. Have to sign up online and pick on what you want to be alerted on and pin your area. Suffolk County uses it. They use a program called Red Alert. New York City has a very similar program, and NASA does as well. It's all on your local emergency management website.
Sounds like there's lots of ways they can give us the message we need during a snowstorm, a superstorm Sandy, a nuclear event, or whatever. There may be a person with either EchoLink or IRLP that's trying to sign in. We're going to let the machine completely drop and give them an opportunity. So, Mystery Voice, sign in, please. K2RAW in the TechNet. Maybe not. Joe, W-H-R-Y-Y, yeah. What was the clue that you had that somebody was trying to sign in by IRLP?
Between you and Eric's transmission, I heard somebody say Joe. And I'm listening on IRLP entirely right now.
I didn't hear IRLP coming.
What we're going to do is periodically give a long delay so that people out of the area that want to sign in have an opportunity to do that. So, PL tones on both encode when you're transmitting, decode when you're receiving, voice-operated relays. There's all kinds of ways that you can be controlling a transmitter, turning on and off. Carrier-operated relay, strength of carrier, in other words, how far the signal strength meter and the receiver moves before the audio is enabled. Lots and lots of ways that your receiver's audio circuit on either transmit or receive can be enabled or disenabled, depending on what you're doing. And some of them are very handy circuits. And you can see how, in the case of an astronaut, his hands are full, his feet are useless inside that suit. He doesn't have a way to reach inside and turn the push the talk button, if you know what I mean. So astronauts tend to use voice-operated relay. And there are times when it chops out keywords. And so there was a big controversy in the case of Neil Armstrong. Did he say small step for man or small step for a man? And lots of people thought he really said a man, but the voice operator really chopped it out. However, just before Neil Armstrong died, he admitted He made the mistake of saying small steps for man. He didn't say the word a man. He finally admitted it. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, personally, I think it's better the way he said it. You can leave a man out. It has a little poetic justice that way. And by the way, Dick, I have Verizon, as you know. And when that EAS system clicks on, I've been monitoring it for the past couple of months. It's at least once a month they do it. And when they lock it up, when they transmit that signal, you cannot change the channel. You can't do anything. The box takes control. And you get this scrolling information that comes across there. But they have never, the last 4 months I've been watching it, they never do it during the commercial. It's only when the program information is going on. I find that horrible. And as you know, most TVs all sync up with the commercials, and they're almost in sync with each other to a point where it's perfect. But I find that quite annoying. They don't interrupt commercials, only the information you're trying to gather. Let me let it drop, and I think we have time for one quick question.
I can explain that if you want to know. Please do, Eric.
They're paying the bill.
Money talk is bigger than truck talk, Eric.
Okay, there's different levels of EAS tests. There's something called the weekly test, which is required of all cable systems and broadcasters, and now even cell phone companies. How those tests get initiated, you, as the owner of your system, get to choose what time and what day you're going to be doing that. Now, the monthly test, okay, actually driven by given sources. Okay, one of the sources is Weather Transmitter 162.55. They'll send out a set of bursts, which will be picked up by all the receivers, which will then force everybody to do that particular test in that region. Depending upon the arrangement, each state has an EAS coordinator, and they originate the monthly messages. It is different from place to place. They will do it by locale, so that way not everybody's doing the same thing all at the same time. But, you know, being happening during the program as opposed to a commercial, well, you know, fuck it, it's all kind of changes. KTRIWP,
looks like there's lots of different ways that the system can be initiated, depending on how important the message and how frequently it's got to be proven that it's working. John, you're going to go on with the next mailbag question, but you're going to precede it by telling us, since you're west of me, and since most of our weather comes from the west, has it started snowing yet on Toad Hill in Richmond County in New York City? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. No snow, Dick. We're supposed to get rain. It's not raining either. But we are expecting ice and rain, but very little snow. But it hasn't started yet.
Okay. Please proceed with your next mailbag question, sir.
Very good. Okay. This gentleman has a question on a socket, a tube socket. He has a tube which is a high voltage tube that's operating, I would imagine, maybe 3,000 volts, something like that. The socket is porcelain, and it's a 5-pin socket. He has a porcelain socket that he can replace it with, and he can mount it by drilling these new holes or whatever he has to do. But his question is, the original socket has molded capacitors in it. They're 470 picofarads. There's two of them. Can he attach just capacitors on the pins, or do you think he's going to have a problem with this? He cannot get the original.
Yeah, I think there's a yes and a no to this one, John. Where I ran into this problem was on the 4CX250B tubes, 4CX150, 4CX250. This is a rather famous tube with 250 watts of plate dissipation. It's got fins in that plate circuit where air is supposed to be directed through those fins. It's got ceramic on the side of the tube. It's got a ring down at the bottom, which is the screen grid ring. And when you plug it into the right kind of a socket, the socket has a capacitor built into it that picks up that lower ring on the perimeter of the tube near the socket, near the base, near the pins. Outside of the pins is this ring, and by way of the capacitor that's built into the socket, you have an extremely low inductance, high current capacity capacitor grounding that screen grid. Let me drop it. And if you're using that tube at, say, 150 or 450 megacycles, you really better use that particular socket with that particular very low inductance built-in capacitor, which does an extremely good job of bypassing that screen grid. When you actually calculate what's happening with the tube when it's in full service is where you're putting 2,000 volts on the plate, 432 megacycles is on that plate, full voltage swing, and I forget the exact number, I think it's 4.5 picofarads is the capacitance between the anode of that tube and its screen grid. And with 2,000 volts swinging on that tube, you have something in the vicinity of 8 RF amperes at 432 megacycles flowing through that screen grid because of the capacitance between that screen grid and the plate that's nearby, and because of the great big voltage swing that's going on with the plate as it's generating power. And when you're putting 8 or 16 RF amperes through a screen grid socket, and you're picking up 16 individual silver-plated fingers on that ring, and they're all going to this very low inductance capacitor built into the socket, that system works very well. Let me drop it.
Did that guy give you a clue as to what this is? It sounds like it's got a high voltage rectifier there.
No, Eric, all I have is a 5-pin porcelain socket. I don't know the tube or the function. I don't know if it's RF or what it's doing. So evidently, it had some type of capacitors that were molded or built into that socket. That's all I know.
Yeah, when you said 5-pin, that reminds me of the very old stuff that had like 470 pumps caps open to the bottom of it. I had a number of TV sets that had them in it, so no. In that case, you could do it, but what Dick's talking about is something completely different.
Well, they are 470s, and it is old. I think this thing is, it's older than 30 years old.
There are people who tried operating tubes with a built-in capacitor by using a socket that didn't have a built-in capacitor, and they added their own capacitor. If you're at a low enough frequency, it works. As you start getting into the UHF frequency, you can get into some trouble. So if it's really a 5-pin tube where the 5 pins are set into a pentagon-like pattern, it does sound like a very old system. Most of those older systems don't operate at UHF frequencies. I think there's a high probability you can put a high-quality capacitor of your own onto the appropriate pin of that socket and get away with it. I think very few of those 5-pin pentagon-faced, you know, spaced pins, and these are rather large diameter pins, I think very few of those ever operated at a UHF frequency. Therefore, the exact inductance of the capacitor may not be critical. As long as your capacitor has a high enough voltage, I think a high enough voltage rating, I believe everything should work hunky-dory. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Well, I'm sure he's listening, so if it is that old and it's not a UHF device, he should probably risk it and put two of those 470p puffs in there and see how he makes out. Okay, I think we should go over to Paul and let's hear about the space report. It's for the mailbag. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
I wouldn't be surprised if that was like an old telephone antenna.
If so, Eric, is that likely to be the horizontal output tube for the flyback transformer of the circuit, or the high voltage rectifier tube? What do you think?
Rack piece of equipment, rack mounted. It's not a TV set.
Okay. Well, that could be high powered audio amplifier for that. It might be thinking maybe it was a full wave rectifier, like a 2565, something like that.
You know, Eric, as I looked at the photograph here, I see there are two loctal base tubes in there. So that tells you how old this thing is.
Say loctal as in 7-volt tubes, like 76s?
Yeah, loctals. The one that had the little round center pin that and that whole thing locked into the socket. Yep.
Those were all my 7-volt filaments.
Yeah, there's two of those, and I have no idea the numbers of them. I have no idea what this device is, but it's a rack-mounted piece of equipment. Okay, I think we covered it enough where he's got a good idea. And you might be right, Eric. It could be an audio amp, maybe something on stage or a theater type of thing. It's possible.
No, I don't think you'd have any problem with the caps if I can. There's no high frequency going on.
In which case, you can get away with murder. Paul, WS2N, I think there was supposed to be a launch today that I think got scrubbed. WS2N with a space report. K2RIW on the TechNet. Did we, I think I heard Paul sign in earlier, did I not, John?
I don't believe I remember Paul checking in. No.
Okay. This is a first. I think Paul may not be with us tonight, and we didn't know about that. He was
asked a question.
What was that again?
I think Wesley had a question.
Let's give one more call for Paul. He was going to give us space report number 135, if he's available. WS2N, if you're there. K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Net, tonight at 8 o'clock, welcome to the W2VL repeater.
And I'm checking, yeah, the Eastern repeater is on the air. Sometimes he comes in through the Eastern repeater. Okay, maybe Paul's not available tonight. What's the subject matter of your question, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. Actually, it wasn't a question. You were talking about the home burners and that was taking care of the house. And I thought that if there is not too much traffic, we could switch to some other subject that would be related to the house. What do you think about it?
Okay. As long as we're not trying to power our house on thorium, go right ahead.
I'm going to keep it light. I was talking to some of the friends and also by myself. I have experience that there is increased number of vandalism on the streets. And sometimes one of the guys said, well, somebody got to my backyard, stole the bike or bicycle or even a shovel, anything like that. Somebody put a trash not in the right place. I've got a ticket whatsoever. So then I thought, that we need some basic protections. And here where the people got lost. So they go for alarm systems, they go for the cameras. But eventually, they find out that so much of the stuff is available on the internet and that stuff is not really working. For so cheap, so little money, you're going to have 12 cameras and the DVR that is recording whatsoever. I thought that people might be interested with what really we should look at if you want to install a camera systems and how could we do it by ourselves, not spending money for the installer. And here's some interesting information. You can buy a camera for as little as $20, and you can buy a camera for as much as $3,000. So somebody might ask, what is the difference? How can I protect my house? How can I have a good picture? How can I have the information for the money that I spent? factors about the cameras is the right sensitivity of the camera, which would be measured in lux. So when you look at the manual or you look at the internet and you're trying to find out if this camera would be good, then the sensitivity would be close to zero. However, there is a catch here. There is no such thing as sensitivity at zero lux. If it's a total night, total darkness, the camera is not going to see and you're not going to see. So then, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 5 years ago, they were trying to increase sensitivity of the camera. So right now, a good camera is 0.0.1 of lux. The camera that would be less sensitive would be 0.0.3. The camera that is still widely used is 0.5. So the larger the number, the more dual the camera it is for the dark. The second thing is a number of lines. Usually you have 480 lines of resolution. You can measure it in pixels. And right now they have another system that you utilize a high quality picture, 760 lines or whatsoever, or high definition. There is another catch here. The system is extremely inconvenient, as when you deliver the picture of the high number of data, which would be the high quality picture, then you will have a lot of data that it will be stored on the hard drive. At that point, instead of having 2-3 months of recording for 1 terabyte of storage, you have 2-3 days of recording. And if you have a 5 or 6 cameras, you might have a 3 to 4 hours of recording. So then, somebody might say, okay, now I know what is the difference between high definition cameras, high number of lines cameras, and the typical 480 lines cameras. Which one should I choose? Well, you can base on price. When you're paying $20, you're gonna buy something that is waste of money. When you're paying $100, you're gonna have waste of money. Usually the good price for the camera is $200 to $250. And one of the cameras that is good, based on my experience, as I have a really good system, is Intensifier. The camera is being called Intensifier and is being made by Spico. This camera is going lower prices. It was $200. Now the outdoor version is $250, $200. You can even buy it for $150 if you're lucky, or you can go to eBay and eventually try to search for it. The interesting thing about this camera is that when I was dealing with nuclear physics, I was dealing with photomultipliers. Now this camera takes as little light as it is and convert it to the signal. So it is sort of a trade-off between night vision, professional night vision or military night vision, and intensifier for the nuclear physics. The quality of picture is outstanding, absolutely amazing. But even though somebody say, hey, I'm going to buy a camera for $60, and this camera has LEDs around, the girland of LEDs around. Guess what? That LEDs, when you see them in the dark, at first they see that the camera is there, the second thing is they give you the flashlight effect. So when you look at the screen, you see something like a bright circle around the face of the person, but you don't see the face. You might see some of that face of that person, but then, because that part of the picture is overlighted and the rest of it is too dark, so the picture is not really good. Intensifier type of cameras, they don't use any kind of infrared light at all. They just take as little light as it is and do it better, then you could see with your eyes much more better. Then the next thing is important to know that, okay, first, we're not choosing the cameras, the infrared cameras.